Before we get started, we've got some news. We're putting on a live show again. We'll be at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York on Wednesday, April 17th for a night of Red Sauce America, celebrating old-school Italian-American restaurants. We're talking red checkered tablecloths, chicken cutlets blanketed in marinara and cheese, booze-soaked tiramisu, and more. It'll be an evening of conversations, readings, food, and drinks. You'll hear from your favorite members of the BA Test Kitchen, our editors, and some outside guests. Doors at 6 p.m., show starts at 7. Tickets are $25 each and are now available at www.thebellhouseny.com/events. We hope to see you there.
It's a Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, we have on Missy Robbins, chef owner of two Brooklyn Italian restaurants. Missy opened Lilia, her first spot, back in 2016. To great acclaim and success. Then last year, she opened the handmade pasta only. Well, it's not exactly pasta only, but we're going to say mostly pasta restaurant, Missy, M-I-S-I. And since its opening, it has become one of the hardest reservations to get in New York City. I chat with Missy about how she got where she is, her menus, and some tips for making great pasta at home. All right, let's do this. Missy, you're not wearing a jumpsuit.
I took it off for this special occasion.
You have one?
No, I have about 15, and I literally feel weird wearing pants now.
Let's talk about the jumpsuit. Is this like a collaboration,
believe this is how we're starting it out.
We are starting it out because you are always in a jumpsuit.
This is what happened, all right?
Yeah, I want to hear.
Tillit came out with the jumpsuit, right?
Yeah.
I got one for my girlfriend. I said, because that's
her. Oh, you bought one for her?
That's her look.
Okay.
She said, you should really try it. And I said, I've never worn a jumpsuit.
I'm not a jumpsuit person.
Well, I said, it's just going to look silly on me. I tried it on and she was like, I think actually it's kind of pretty good on you. And then I started wearing them and then I was like, oh, this feels good. And then people just started complimenting it. And then I just kept buying them. And now people are sending me jumpsuits to like beyond Tillit. Uh-huh. So I don't have a collaboration with Tillit.
I'm
good friends with Jenny, and We have a collaboration in terms of, like, she's working on a summer one inspired by me right now, and she'll probably sell it, but it's coming soon. A very light blue one.
Ooh, nice.
Per my request.
Kind of a periwinkle, or
I don't know what periwinkle is. Much more fashionable than I am.
I'm not sure I do. What kind of an Easter egg blue?
So anyway, I don't know. The jumpsuit thing has just become a thing. And now I'm really comfortable wearing them, and I don't have to think about... It's pretty awesome to have a uniform.
You don't have to worry about what to wear. It's the best.
Ever now. But it is a little weird. Like, my wardrobe has really shrunk into 15 jumpsuits.
Have you given Tillit input in terms of, like, oh, you know, it'd be really great if you did a little slot here to put my thermometer or my pen or something?
I give them feedback on fit more than anything.
Oh, important.
But no. But I have, like, a friend of mine is a stylist, and she was like, oh, I have something for you. And she brought by a jumpsuit by a friend of hers who's making them now, and they wanted my feedback. Which me and fashion and giving designers feedback just seems like a very silly, silly prospect, but it's kind of fun at the same time.
You're like a muse, as they say.
Yeah, I found my calling in jumpsuits.
All right, so you opened Missy last year, and it has since become the most popular restaurant in the history of New York.
That is not true.
No, it is true. We did a study on it. The history of ever.
So far, it's been busy. Yeah,
it's been good. Busy.
I'm not upset.
All right. So let's talk about the concept of Missy, which I kind of love. But I love that there's not a lot to choose from. You go to some of those restaurants that have like this Cheesecake Factory menu where there's just like, you're like, oh my God, like, I don't know. Should I get this? Should I get that? There's different sections. There's just too much choice. You decided obviously to go in the opposite direction with Missy, and I'm curious what the strategy was behind that.
I don't know if it was so much a strategy as like a a passion. And so the idea for Missy actually happened a long, long time ago before Lilia ever opened. And it's something I've wanted to do for a long time, especially the pasta part. And the vegetable part kind of grew into it as I became more of a vegetable eater over the past 4 or 5 years. And so I've always wanted to do this concept. When we found the space for Lilia, it just didn't make sense there. Like, and I think it would have been a little too ballsy a move to be like, I'm just going to open a pasta restaurant after I had been gone for 2 years. And I just needed to reestablish myself. And we had this opportunity to have wood fire at Lilia and do all these other things. So it didn't, it just, I wanted to open Lilia and make Lilia what it was. And Lilia does have a fairly extensive menu.
Yeah. Pasta and pastas are part of that.
And as we opened Lilia and people were really responding to the pastas, which people responded to my pastas in the past at Avoce and other places, but not to the way they were responding to these. And I was never known at Avoce for pasta. Mm-hmm. I was just known as like cooking decent food. And so I saw this happening.
Was that on your card? I cook decent food.
I saw this happening and we saw how much pasta we were selling. And it was sort of just a natural progression that that would be the next thing. We decided to take these two things, vegetables and pasta, that were really, really successful at Lilia and two things that I'm super passionate about and kind of go with it and try it out and see how it worked. And in my, like, idea of what Missy wanted to be, I wanted it to be much smaller. I pictured
smaller footprint wise, literally.
Yes. Uh-huh. I always pictured it to be this sort of 50 seat place with a counter, like, and a bar,
like Isotti or something almost.
Yeah, but like it was supposed to really just be focused on that kitchen bar situation. Yep. And then we found the space and we looked at spaces. My partner Sean started looking at spaces like 3 weeks after we opened Lilia. Yeah. And I was like, you go do your thing, but I'm actually gonna keep trying to make Lilia okay.
Yeah.
And that's why I think he's amazing, because he knew how long it was gonna take and he had this vibe that we could do a second place. And
I want to interject, but I think a lot of times the average food lover, quote unquote, doesn't necessarily realize how critical it is for a chef to have a business partner that they're in sync with, who can do all these things like find the space and deal with the lease and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do it all on my own. And I never, ever wanted to open a restaurant by myself. Like, yeah. I always wanted a business partner. And what I found in Sean was a real business partner. And I always thought I would find sort of the front of house partner, and he's very involved in the front of the house, but not in the like day-to-day of training people on service and stuff like that. But I really appreciate what, like, how he operates like that. And so he was looking for spaces and we would go look at things, and this came along, and it was sort of the second time after Lilia that we both walked into somewhere and said, this makes sense. Yeah. And it was really about the location and being able to be part of the South Williamsburg community and continue our growth in Williamsburg and not have to come into Manhattan and sort of continue what we'd already built. And the space happened to be very large. And we decided to just make it work, but I also wouldn't be able to have my very special pasta room if I didn't have a large space, because you wouldn't be able to take up that much real estate by doing that.
But you also, because it was a new build, were you able to basically build and design the kitchen as you wanted to?
Oh, yeah, we did it from scratch. Yeah. There was nothing.
And that's pretty awesome.
It was amazing. There was nothing there. I made a couple mistakes. But
for anyone who's ever renovated an apartment, we all make mistakes.
But overall,
What was your number one mistake?
I think I didn't realize like how many hot dishes I would have coming off of antipasti.
So your vegetable starters.
Yeah, and like I just don't have enough oven space.
Yeah.
And it's really crowded, and I was so focused on making sure I had enough room to cook 300 pastas a night and have that space that I didn't, it's not that there's not space down there, it's just not necessarily configured the right way. And you make, look, you make every kitchen work. It doesn't, at the end of the day, you figure it out and you work around it and whatever. We didn't put wood fire in Missy either. And part of me was really excited about that at the beginning. And I was like, it's going to force me to sort of cook differently and think differently and not rely on this grill that's pretty easy to put amazing food on and garnish and you get amazing cooking. And I was excited about that. But I miss having wood fire. And I think I was so intent on making it different visually and different technically than Lilia. And because it was in the same neighborhood, that I did make that choice not to do wood fire. And then I was like, well, having a wood fire is the same as having like a gas stove. Like, it's a piece of equipment. So that was, I don't know if it's a mistake, but I definitely miss having it.
How many covers are you doing a night right now on a busy night?
275-ish.
And so 300. On a typical menu, how many starters, how many pastas?
So we have 10 and 10, always. 10
and 10. Yeah. Has that increased? Since
it has not. It has not increased or decreased.
I'm gonna read a few right now on your current menu. So we have a raw fennel and celery with Parmigiano and walnuts. Grilled baby artichokes, mint salsa verde. Had that. That's delicious. Some charred marinated peppers with marjoram and whipped ricotta. That's like the ricotta that looks like it comes out of a shaving cream can.
Yeah, people are fascinated by it.
It's fascinating.
I get more questions about how I make that, and it's so,
because it comes on a charred piece of bread, and it looks like marshmallow?
Fluff.
Yeah. It looks like fluff that comes out of a CO2 container or something. So what was the inspiration behind that?
I've always done ricotta like this. Like, I've always used whipped ricotta. It's really quite simple.
But it's like, it's not just whipped.
Yes,
it's not.
There is not even actually technically whipped. I'll reveal my big secret here. It goes into a Roboku food processor and just gets like spun, really, more than anything, until it's super smooth. There's no oil in it.
And then how do you put it on the toast?
We put it in a little piping bag.
A pastry bag.
Pastry bag, and it gets piped on.
So if your listeners out there, Google Missy Robbins whipped ricotta toast. And it's just very cool to look at. It's very Instagram friendly also.
Yes, it's very Instagram friendly, which is not what I think about when I design dishes. But
no, but that is one of those dishes that when you're at the restaurant and it goes by, people are like, oh, what's that?
Yeah.
We need to get that.
Yeah. We sell about 50 a night.
Yeah, that's what else? Braised butter beans, Tuscan kale, bacon, Parmigiano, radicchio, melted bone marrow, cipollini onions. I love the vegetable portion of this menu, and I do think more and more people, and I think more and more chefs, I think that's probably the biggest trend over the last 5 years that we at BA as editors have noticed, is how creatively and enthusiastically chefs are cooking with vegetables now.
It's fun and it's challenging.
Yeah, you know, not just a steak which you're going to grill or pan sear and that's that.
Yeah, it really, to me, I've always been more of a fish person in terms of, it's funny, like I like to eat meat more than I like to eat fish, but I like to cook fish more than I like to cook meat. And I think part of that is having, I feel like fish really lends itself to more creativity. And I feel the same with vegetables. And they all have their unique properties and characteristics. And all I'm trying to do is really enhance them and not really take that much away from them and not add too much, but bring out the flavors within.
Let's talk about one of my favorite when I was there was your mushroom dish.
Oh, that's long gone.
Is it coming back?
It may.
What do you mean it may? It was so good.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, chanterelles went out of season.
That's the other thing about vegetables. Vegetables are seasonal. Yeah. So that's also what's fun about from a chef perspective. Yeah. Like, I haven't done artichokes in a while.
I can't wait for spring. Like, so, I'm dying. Like, winter's tough for me.
Okay, all right. You know what? So we were just having this discussion in a story ideas meeting, and Meryl Rothstein, one of our editors, she just said, you know what? Spring is a myth. And like in New York, you wait and wait and wait for spring.
It's true.
And then all of a sudden it's 90 degrees out. And you're like, wait, no, last weekend that was spring.
Yeah, the spring food, because you think like, oh, it's March, it's spring, which is not true.
No, it's raining and snowing.
The only two things available spring-like right now are white asparagus coming from France
Yeah.
that's so crazy expensive, and I've seen nettles around from a couple of...
You know what? You know people don't like nettles. Like, chefs are always like, ooh, we have a nettle pesto. Like, no one wants your stinging nettles. they look cool, but no one wants to eat those.
And I'm so eager for spring that I texted my ramp guy yesterday.
Oh, ramp
guy. And was like, I know I'm really early, but when are you coming?
When are you ramping up?
When are you coming? Yeah. And I was like, and by the way, we're going to do twice the volume because I have another restaurant now.
So when I go back to Missy in the fall and there'll be the mushroom dish on the menu, how did you make that dish?
So those were chanterelles that were very, very slowly cooked in olive oil with rosemary.
And that's what I loved about it. It came and you were like, it looked like beautiful mushrooms. It tasted like beautiful mushrooms. And you were kind of like, that's all I want and that's all I need. And that's what I love so much about Italian food, seemingly at its best, is that it takes ingredients, it treats them properly, but it never over-treats them.
Yeah, and that's the goal with every vegetable, is trying to bring out the best in that vegetable and trying to sort of come up with unique ways to deal with them. And everyone can saute a chanterelle. And I've done chanterelles and pastas 100 times, but to take a full dish of chanterelles, was just fun. People really love that dish. It could come back. Sous chefs will not be happy if that comes back.
They have to clean them all and everything?
They have to get cleaned. Yeah. They go through 6 cases of olive oil a day because of it.
Cleaning mushrooms is not fun. By the time fall rolls around, you'll be ready for it again. I actually had an Italian food question.
I hope I can answer it.
I think there's something about Italian food. About not being Italian. Are you at all Italian? Partly
nope.
Italian? All right. So
I'm going to take 23andMe, though, to prove it.
I'm going to say
I'm positive there's something in there.
I don't want to necessarily say the best Italian cooks aren't Italian, but just in terms of my own eating habits. All right. Love your food, going back to Ovoce. I go to Ultra Paradiso a lot, where Ignacio Matos is the chef, South American. Yep. Jody Williams, she's not Italian, is she?
I don't know. I don't think so.
No.
Her
partner,
her
Rita, is.
So, yeah.
But Jody Williams, that we've had in the podcast at Via Carota and stuff, not Italian. Claire and Jess over at King, not Italian.
Oh, interesting. Really interesting pattern you're noticing here.
So, but I do think there's something that resonates with cooks in Italian food, that there is that respect for ingredients and there's that simplicity, which is not easily gotten until you have a sort of a better understanding of what good food is.
That's how I got into Italian cooking. So I grew up in Connecticut, like I said, and I was always sort of obsessed. My mom would take me to the pasta store and to the Italian cheese store and to all these places. And what resonated me always as a kid was the ricotta and the mozzarella and the olive oil and olives and all that stuff. And then when I started cooking as a young cook, I was always really most excited when the ingredients arrived that day. And that's what excited me the most. And I think I didn't start cooking Italian food until 10 years in my career. And once I started, I kind of couldn't stop.
Yeah, so talk about those first 10 years quickly. We were talking about this in the elevator about where you get started as a chef.
First 10 years were picking the best chefs, the best restaurants. And for me, I didn't want to get pigeonholed. I wanted to experience as many chefs and as much cuisine as I can. I was just talking about this the other day with someone that I thought I wanted to actually focus on Asian cuisine.
And this was mid-90s.
Yeah. And, Jean George was using all these Asian ingredients. I worked at March with Wayne Nish is, I think, a quarter Japanese and used a lot of Japanese ingredients and influence in the food without it being Asian. And I was really inspired by that, but I was also way more drawn to Italian ingredients and pasta making and all those things. And I think for me, we talked about, at the time I moved to New York in 94 and there was I remember I did my internship with Wayne Nish after school, and I remember giving him a list of restaurants that I wanted to work. And it probably had the top 20 restaurants that I took out of Zagat at the time.
There were fewer quality restaurants in the country and also in New York then. Well, and there really was that list that you would carry around.
And there was a standard of you have to go do fine dining or fine-ish dining. And now you can go work at a pizza place, or you can go work at a ramen place, or you can go work at Le Bernardin, and your resume to me as a chef now is going to be just as good.
Yeah.
Because as long as you're working with a good chef who's focusing on their craft, you have some sort of skill. And while you might not have the fine dining skills or knife skills, you're still going to have that passion and that understanding of how a kitchen operates. And I think that's amazing. I think that's an amazing thing for the industry. And for me, now that I'm cooking more casual food and can still get really quality cooks, because there isn't this stigma that you have to go work in a super fancy restaurant to get the right experience.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm curious about having your own restaurant as opposed to working with, for someone else. So you followed up Andrew Carmelini at Avoce.
Yes.
And you certainly got well recognized and appreciated for your work there. But it seems to be certainly on a different level than it is now. Working for a place that you were not the owner, was not your name outside, although they spelled your name incorrectly on the sign out in Missy. Just want to let you know. But so, yeah, what's like working for someone as opposed to working for yourself?
Oh, my God. It's the most amazing thing, working for yourself. I got into this business originally when I was 22 years old and always had this goal to open a restaurant by the time I was 30. And
so you told yourself that?
Yes. I don't know where that came from, but when I was 22 and I started cooking in college, and then I decided to go into it when I graduated 6 months later.
Georgetown University.
Georgetown.
Go Hoyas.
Yes. I went to one Hoyas game my entire time there. Very, very bad.
That was a lightning round question coming up. You might not miss it.
Bad
like that one.
Hoya. Yeah. I had this goal to open when I was 30, but I ended up continuing to get great jobs. And so like every time I thought I was going to open a restaurant, I did something else. So when I ended up at Spiaggia, and that was a really important mood for me to go to Chicago and re-enter into fine dining, where I'd sort of left for a few years to work in a hotel, as we talk about hotels.
Yep.
And then before I left Spiaggia, I was trying to open my own place in New York, and I was flying back and forth to New York and looking at real estate. I had zero idea what I was doing. I had to find investors. It was so terrifying to me. And the Avoce job came along, and I was like, okay, this can get me back to New York.
Yep.
And have some security and have a good job and make a name for myself in New York. And that from that perspective, Avoce was really important in my career. And I think it was the right choice, because if I had opened I came back to New York 10 years ago. And so if I had opened 10 years ago, Lilia wouldn't be Lilia.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have had the success that I've had, because I don't think I had the confidence to do it then. And so I think Avoce gave me a lot of confidence, and followed by 2 years off gave me just a peace of mind and a new perspective on how I wanted to run a restaurant and how I wanted to be in the restaurant and what kind of food I wanted to cook. And I never opened, so I had that goal when I was 30, and I never opened Lilia till I was 44 years old. And I really don't regret that. I mean, I actually almost am psyched about it, because I really believe that it has helped with the success of Lilia. And so back to the original question of owning your own place, I mean, knock on wood, I hope that it lasts for a very, very long time, because I don't want to go get a job ever again. I'm lucky. I chose a great business partner, and we started a company that's based in the same values and based in wanting to create an amazing environment for our staff and for our guests. And being able to do that every day, aside from the cooking and the creativity and all that stuff, is actually more gratifying to me than the cooking part of it at this point in my career. Like, I've done
the cooking. You've been doing it for a long time.
I've done the cooking
for 20-some years.
Yeah, and so being able to start a company and be an owner of that company and shape the way that the company moves forward and operates on a day-to-day basis and being able to mentor all of these people is by far the most gratifying thing I've done.
Okay, speaking of cooking, let's talk cooking quickly before we get to lightning round.
Yes.
So for the home cook, how do we make great pasta at home in the way that you make in the restaurant? So let's take, for instance, you have your very simple but I imagine delicious fettuccine with buffalo butter, parmigiana, extra vecchio, and black pepper. Simple as could be. People try to make that
there's
at home sometimes. It gets all the cheese gets clumpy.
There's a
it's
book
too watery.
Coming out in 2020 that's going to teach you exactly how to do
that. Well, let's give them a sneak preview.
Listen, I think the most important thing is if you can't make your own pasta to buy very high quality fresh pasta.
Yep. And if you have like an Italy type market, you can. Or if you have a local market where it makes, you buy the little spool of fettuccine.
And if you can't buy fresh, you know, if you're in a place that doesn't have super fresh pasta, you can buy a very good dried product.
Yeah. What do you think about like the imported like egg noodle, the dried ones that are more yellowy pasta from Italy?
I don't use that a lot, but I think there are very good brands out there. But I also think there's dried, not egg pasta that you could substitute in this dish.
All right, so we have good pasta to start with.
Good pasta, salted water.
Yeah, let's talk about that because chefs talk about how much they salt the water. So if you
hate that, don't you?
No,
editors hate that.
No, I love it. So let's say you're making pasta you're making pasta for two people, and your wife. How much salt are you putting in the water?
I'm so bad at like the amounts, but it should taste salty, like saltier than you think. Like you should taste that water. And I can tell, like when I'm working and throughout the night I'm tasting pasta, I can tell when my cook's tank isn't salted enough. You can tell in the pasta, it'll taste bland. Yeah. No matter how much sauce is on that pasta. And
the pasta itself won't be flavorful enough.
No matter how much you sauce it, you can always taste if the pasta water's not salted. Never put oil in the salt in the water.
Yeah, what's that all about?
Never.
So it doesn't stick together. That nonsense.
Right, but then your sauce will never stick to the pasta.
Ooh, nice.
So that's the theory behind that. And then again, great ingredients like great Parmigiano, great butter.
Yep.
That's kind of the key to my cooking is finding really good ingredients and not manipulating them that much, but. That buffalo butter comes from Italy. It is available in grocery stores.
I've seen that before. Not cheap, but delicious.
It's not cheap, but it's available.
Is that the one that's almost kind of white looking, the butter itself?
Yeah, it's kind of white and not as fatty.
Yeah.
Like it almost looks like, I don't want to say watery.
Yeah.
But no, it
has like a lard-like appearance.
Yes, very much so.
So you've got the pasta, you cook it to almost done. You got a fry pan of some sort.
Yeah, a little saute pan.
And you're warming the butter in there.
And you have a little butter and your pasta water. Pasta water is very important.
So let's talk for two people, how much pasta water are you putting in there?
4 ounces.
So that's half a cup.
Yeah.
Okay.
Four-ish ounces.
Four-ish based on the size of the pan.
And you can always add a little bit, like if your pasta starts to feel...
So the butter and pasta water are kind of simmering together.
Yep.
Dump the pasta in there.
Dump the pasta and then marry it for a minute or
that's
two.
That's like when you chefs do the fancy thing
when
you
we do the
elliptically
fancy thing.
Toss.
Yes, you elliptically toss.
So my question is this. So you're making some version of a cacio e pepe, which everyone loves these days. How and when do you add the cheese? Because I think a lot of people, they add
always,
the cheese and it clumps up or it gets like sticky in the bottom of the
when
pan.
When you're like about to serve it. So you pull it off the heat and then add your cheese.
You're doing the tossy thing.
You're tossing it, but like not on the heat.
Yep. And you're adding the cheese bit by bit, kind of?
Just like in a nice stream.
Oh, you did the little like Salt Bay thing where you raise your hand
up.
No,
that's
the pinkies. That's the fingers.
Just in a little stream so that it's like gradually entering the pan. If you throw it all in at once, it's just going to clump up.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So it's glossy, as I like to say a lot. You tossing it, cheese. So you got the butter, the water, the cheese. You got that emulsification. Are you the type of person who gets mad if people don't eat their pasta immediately?
Yeah.
It's like, it's hot.
Have
eat
you
it now.
Heard yes. that about me?
No, but I imagine you're
you know,
that type of person.
There's a real trend. You mentioned is Instagram pretty dishes. Mm-hmm. There's a real trend with the youngsters today to stop and take pictures for like a real extended amount of time. And I have definitely been known to go over to tables and be like, eat the food and stop taking pictures. But it's amazing because every time
You should make t-shirts.
Eat the food and stop taking pictures. Yeah. I love that idea. Yeah. Every time I've done it, I've made friends with the people and they've become huge regulars. There's this one particular group who's probably now been collectively to both restaurants 40 times since I yelled at them.
What if it's a cold appetizer like the
they
like
can
the,
do
like
whatever.
The ricotta toast with the peppers?
Well, the ricotta toast isn't cold because it has warm bread and the peppers
but it's not like hot
like
pasta.
A salad to go to town. Take as many pictures as you want. But pasta like really changes. My other...
Yeah, and the sauce also, especially a butter sauce kind of, I don't want to say congeals.
Yeah,
a little
it does.
Bit. Yeah, it does.
My other thing about pasta and eating it in the restaurant is I always encourage people to not move it from the bowl to the share plate.
Oh yeah,
and if they
you want the good stuff in the bottom of the bowl and everything.
If they know each other well enough, by the time you move it and then you're changing it, and you just like lose some of the essence of like getting in there and twirling.
Well, because I'm a firm believer that if you take part of it and put it on another plate, the part that's left in the bowl is always going to be better because there's always the sauce sort of collects on the bottom.
Yeah, so
of the bowl.
If it was up to me, I wouldn't even offer share plates in my restaurant. Because I just think it's nice to eat right off the plate, but
I think
you should become
more of a dictator. That needs to be more of your reputation.
Like,
no photos, no share plates.
No photos, no
deal
share.
With
no,
it.
I like that people are taking photos. I just want them to do it quicker.
What? All right. Before we get to lightning round, to cause a little East West Coast drama. Have you been to Felix? What's your Evan Funky take?
I have been to Felix. I think what he does is awesome. We're very different. We cook very, very differently.
See, that's interesting because we both, I think the average diner, like, oh, they make fresh pasta. They're into pasta. They have a pasta room. Mm. They're basically the same people.
I think Evan has this amazing attachment to real classics. Mm-hmm. And putting his own spin on those on those classics. So if you go and you look at his menu, and I've only been there once, but if you go and look at his menu, it's like amatriciana and cacio e pepe.
And he divides it into region, and you get the pesto, and you get the bolognese. That's true.
I'm all over the map.
I mean, we've got some chickpea pappardelle with the chickpeas, rosemary, garlic, parmigiano, spinach and mascarpone filled tortelli with brown butter, ricotta salata. There's a lot going on where you're like, oh, and you have some fennel pollen or this or that on it, you know.
But what's interesting is that I used to be more like Evan.
Yeah.
So when I started in Italian cooking and I didn't know anything and I was working with Tony Montuano in
love Tony.
I love Tony too. He came to Missy the other night
the
first time.
Nice to see He's like Chicago nice.
But he's also really funny.
Yeah.
You got to just get him. Give him a couple of tequila shots.
Oh, no, I've been around
him, yes. Give him a couple tequila shots, he's fine. I used to be so strict about, like, if you're making bolognese, it has to be bolognese. And I just, as I evolved and evolved and evolved, I just sort of got away from that. And I for myself, didn't want to cook with as many rules as I used to. And when I opened Lilia, I think, again, going back to the confidence, you know, point is that I think I gained enough confidence and knowledge about all the regional stuff that I felt comfortable enough veering away from it a little bit. But when I started Avoce, I was like, oh, well, you can only call that bolognese if it has those seven ingredients in it or whatever. And then all of a sudden at Lilia, I'm making veal and porcini bolognese that doesn't exist. So
I think like a lot of artists like that, they start off with like the core principles of a technique and then they sort of find their own
but
way.
I used to just be so much more like, this is the dish and this is how it's done. And maybe certainly at Spiaggia, the goal was to do fancified versions of those dishes, and there was always a garnish and a thing, but it was still like the dish.
Yeah.
And they've evolved away from that also. I do think that Evan really has an understanding of true regional, especially the Emilia Romagna world.
Yeah, I think an understanding and a meticulous appreciation for.
Yes.
All right, ready for lightning round?
Sure. Don't make it too hard, please.
Oh,
I'm
just
not
either
that quick
or.
On my, not, oh.
Bellini or Negroni?
Negroni.
straight up regular classic?
Yeah.
Do you have them frequently?
No, not a huge drinker, but okay. But yeah, I mean, that's like my drink. If I'm craving a drink, it's usually a Negroni.
All right, Italy, north or south?
Oh man, well, I've spent more time in the north, and I'm eager to spend more time in the south.
There's a lot of butter on your menu, buttery olive oily stuff, which I love. I definitely lean that way.
I think there's more olive oil than butter. There's definitely more olive oil than butter.
Yeah, maybe.
Listen, I've studied the whole country, and my food definitely comes from all over, but I am doing a big southern trip this summer, and it'll be the first time in like Puglia and Sicily and Calabria, and those are places that I use a lot of those ingredients, and I've never been there. So can I say both?
No.
Okay.
We're giving you the north.
Okay.
clogs or sneakers?
Sneakers.
What kind? At work?
These days, Adidas. Stan Smiths.
Okay, cool. That was a good one. Chuck or axe?
What?
Billions.
Oh. Oh, you know I like Billions.
Yeah.
Oh, axe.
TV show or cookbook?
What does that mean?
What would you rather have? You can have a TV show or you can have a cookbook next year.
Well, I'm having a cookbook.
Okay, so there you go. Is there a name and when does it come out?
It doesn't have a name. It is all about pasta.
And it'll be out?
Fall 2020.
Fall 2028. Yeah. All right, look for that. Call Me By Your Name or La Dolce Vita?
Mmm. Wow. Call Me By Your Name was an incredible movie. I'm going with it because I've seen it more recently.
It makes it that was the one film where it felt the most like you're just hanging out in Italy.
That was an amazing movie.
They really captured the vibe incredibly well. It was a gelato question, which you only serve at Misi, only dessert.
I like how you say Misi.
Misi. pistachio or hazelnut?
Oh, pistachio, which just went on the menu.
Ooh, I love a good pistachio, like a real pistachio gelato.
Please come by.
Nutty tasting and not just green.
Please, it's not green, yeah. First of all. It's like puke color, and that probably doesn't.
No,
that's
right.
Not a great selling point, actually. But it's not bright green. It's made with real pistachio, and we chop Sicilian pistachios to put in it. And
oh my god! So we have the crunchy. It's like a crunchy peanut butter sort of thing.
Ooh,
why you don't get that ever? Like with gelato.
It's always. Like, I worked on this pistachio like a ridiculous.
I'm coming for that. I was going to ask you AI or Alonzo, but since you only went to one Hoya game, I'm not sure even you know
Alonzo,
who they are.
Alonzo, he used to hang out on my floor all
okay.
the time. I think he was dating someone in my dorm my sophomore year.
I imagine. All right, good answer.
I have a father and a brother who also went to Georgetown, so
okay.
Georgetown basketball was
in your blood.
In the world, yes.
Long sleeve jumpsuit or short sleeve jumpsuit?
Begging Jenny for a winter long sleeve.
Yeah. Seasonal. It's like your vegetables. You have seasonal jumpsuits.
Seasonal jumpsuits, please.
Do you ever do like the more linen-y jumpsuits? Or are you
waiting for it. The one that she's working on for me now is going to be much thinner. Because my feedback to her last year, when I started wearing the jumpsuits, it was summer. And they're very hot.
Yeah.
And even like outside the kitchen, in the kitchen, they're just hot.
Yeah, despite those ones are more work suits.
Despite the fact that they are short sleeve.
Subway, bike, or Uber?
Uber.
All right, living large. A couple more. How about clams or oysters?
Clams. That's hands down.
Do you typically do them in a pasta? Do you prefer them vongole style, sort of?
I like clam pasta.
Yeah, I do too. Quite good. Okay, what about salt, fat, acid, heat, or ugly delicious?
Salt, whatever it's called, salt,
yeah.
Fat, acid, heat.
But you got it.
Yeah.
It's a fun show.
I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautifully shot. Informative.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love it.
All right, last question. Butter or olive oil?
Olive oil.
Thank you, Ms. Robbins.
Thank you.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.